London is actually a bit of a strange place to live in, because anyone who lives in London knows that in fact the city is really just an extended series of towns, not like each other. Brixton is not like Southwark. Southwark is certainly not like King's Cross. King's Cross is not Kensington, and Kensington is certainly not Tower Hamlets. These are not just neighbourhood differences. These were once all separate towns and villages, and over time, London has enveloped and overgrown them as the centuries have passed. And given that we are now in the history of the city, deep inside the 13th century, we have to take on board certain indelible truth. Almost all of the towns of London, from Barking to Wembley to Kensington to Islington, were not, at this moment, part of London. These towns were kind of over there, and London was kind of over here. In fact, in the 13th century, there were only two towns that bordered on London. To the south, you had the Southwark, Southwark, linked by the Great Stone Bridge, a gated and lived upon community in its own right. And if you followed the river upstream by a mile or so, you would come eventually to Thorny Island, the triangle of land that contained the Abbey and the Palace and became known as Westminster. And in the years to come, in this chapter, we're going to see Westminster begin to expand. A lot. We always see it as London doing all the expanding and growing, but that was not always the case. Westminster in this time was doing the expanding and growing, and there are reasons for this. And the reasons were to lead to what was either the first clash of rival sports fans in London, or something much darker. Hi there, my name is Saul and you are listening to The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to telling the history of the city in regular weekly chunks, each week taking us a little further along the timeline of its tale. And this week we cover 6 years where Westminster grew up really quickly and relations with London got, apparently, very, very bad. And a man was to end up being hung by the neck and killed. And the story of why he got hung provides us with what could be a really interesting insight into the politics of the city at this time. Welcome then to chapter 87 in the story of London, The Lamentable Death of Constantine FitzAnulf. We begin this chapter in the year 1220, and we start our story with the tale of the king. The 13-year-old boy, King Henry, had begun to emerge from his boyhood era into the man he would become. 1220 saw the most significant event of his young life so far. On Whit Sunday, the 17th of May that year, Henry was formally crowned by the Archbishop of Canterbury in Westminster Abbey. Unlike the fast and rather cheap ceremony he had experienced over in Winchester during the war, where his mum had to supply jewellery to act as a crown, this occasion saw a ceremony that was resplendent in form and grandeur. The day before this glorious coronation, he had laid the foundation stone of a new chapel which the monks had planned to build in the new style of architecture to the east of the primitive Norman choir of Westminster Abbey. This was the first step of his plans to complete an ambitious design for the building of a new church for the abbey. He laid the stone as part of his coronation ceremony, and it signified huge changes in the young man's mind. What kind of changes? Well, firstly, the young boy decided that he would make his patron saint the dead king, Edward the Confessor. In his life to come, Henry III was to create a massive cult to the saintly former ruler, using the spirit of the sainted king to indulge both his artistic passions and his love of ceremony. The feast day of Edward the Confessor, October the 13th, became King Henry's most important day of the year, which was useful because it was conveniently placed a fortnight after Michaelmas, the beginning of the financial year, when the Exchequer was busy, Westminster was crowded, and a great council of Parliament was generally held. Therefore, every October, Henry was wont to gather about him the members of his household, dress them in new robes which he'd provide for them, and would knight young nobles and protégés, and hold grand feasts. In due course, he made himself responsible for the building of that new church here in Westminster, and it was to become his principal architectural project. But it was not the only large-scale building project he unleashed upon London and the surrounding regions. Lest we forget, even now in 1220, his regime was not fully stable. There were still issues, such as rebellions and a change in the regent, but I'll discuss that in a bit. And this made there be causes of concern about the geopolitical stability of the nation. And so a massive building project was ordered on the other side of the City of London. The Tower of London was expanded. This rebuilding was the largest expansion the Tower had seen, and it took place over the next decade, refortifying and expanding the compound. The eastern boundary of the Tower, the old Roman wall, was finally fully demolished, and land was taken up to construct a new curtain wall, and also extra towers were added. The present Wardrobe Tower, where you can find a recreation of the throne of Henry III today, was built to the east of the White Tower, marking probably the old eastern boundary of the castle's precincts. The new expanded castle also included a new wall to the north and northwest of the White Tower. The Blundeville Tower was constructed, although we now call that the Wakefield Tower, and most agree that Lanthorn Tower was begun. The expansion to the north and west is delineated by the line of towers in that direction from the White Tower. So we're talking about Devereux, Flint, Boyer, Martin, Constable, Broad Arrow and Salt Towers, all dating to this time. And with this expansion, the church, which had long been linked to the Tower of London, St. Peter ad Vincula, or St. Peter's in Chains, was now brought within the walls of the giant construction. This much grander and more impressive Tower of London, reinforced now, remained as it had always been, the potent symbol of royal power over the City of London. It was terrible, and it was growing. Now, when it came to royal power and the intricacies of politics of the new regime between the years 1217 and 1220, I could happily bore you with intricate details about the peace settlement with King Alexander of Scotland, the failure of the peace with Llywelyn of Wales, the reissuing of the Magna Carta, which was really the Charter of Rights and the equally as important Charter of the Forest. And we could talk about loads more done by the Regency Council led by William Marshall. And these were all very important political issues which the regime had to deal with. The problem is, I've been spending way too much of last few episodes talking about not London. So suffice to say, the focus of the regime had been trying to restore the government of England for the boy king, and there was a lot going on in the rest of the country. And one thing I must stress that was to have a huge impact upon London and upon the story going forward is the simple and utterly unavoidable issue that the young king was fundamentally broke, seriously broke. In 1217, when John's regime was on its last legs, only four sheriffs had been able to turn up to pay the annual tax revenues of the crown. In the opening year of young Henry's rule, this had improved considerably. 15 sheriffs or their deputies turned up, which sounds great. But when you consider that they raised a combined paltry sum of around £216, you realise, Houston, we have a problem. That first pipe roll of the new regime, covering the accounts of the sheriffs since the war, vividly reflects the state of utter chaos in England, the carnage caused by Prince Louis's invasion. It is estimated that even as this situation improved over the years, the young king's cash revenue from ordinary sources was probably running to about £4,500 a year. To understand how bad that is, understand that this was about four times smaller than what was being raised during his father's reign. So before he even got that formal crown on his head, the young king needed a massive tax system rehaul, and the business of the exchequer needed a huge reorganization. This was the first big crisis the regime had to begin working with. And we know this financial crisis was impacting upon the wider countryside and as such impacted upon London. And proof of this? Well, the city had received a fine of 2,000 silver marks to have the papal interdict that had been placed upon it lifted. And by 1223, London had made 7 instalments to pay this off. But their payments in the exchequer after these 7 instalments still only amounted to £675. Why were things so bad? Well, the simplest and most honest explanation was that the country had been devastated by the war, and so devastated that the sheriffs could not properly collect in their monies to give to the exchequer. In some regions, the physical damage done by the war was indeed extensive, but the war had also shaken the king's local power in many parts of England, making it basically impossible to exploit the traditional sources of revenue. The situation was particularly bad in the eastern counties, which contained the centre of the rebellion. And this actually did lead to the other big thing that was to impact upon Westminster, and the other thing that the young king needed to sort out. And that was during the first years of his regency, now with the expectation that the Magna Carta was this legally empowered document, it was felt that dealing with legal issues needed reform and restitution. A new system of royal justice, a general ayry, was introduced, with roving judges travelling the country to hear both criminal and civil cases. This general ayry was not popular, however, because it was financially very burdensome to local regions, largely through the variety of costs or amercements which the judges imposed on local communities in the course of hearing criminal pleas. But the need for the cash revenues these generated meant that it was vital for the minority government to resist any attempt to restrict or replace it, and there were more than a few. The legal systems had been the first casualties of war, it seemed, and even the Justiciar of the realm, Hubert de Burgh, when he went over to Norfolk and Suffolk in the summer of 1218 to hear petty assizes, he'd been unable to get men to accept the verdicts of juries, large numbers of which were challenged. What was needed in 1218, therefore, was a great nationwide legal reform that could disperse effective justice, generate major revenues, and impress the authority of the government upon the kingdom. And to some extent, it kind of worked, and the judges do seem to fulfill their boasts to, quote, give justice to each and everyone, poor as well as rich, unquote. And it is worth noting how many of the judges sent out turned to be former rebels from the recent civil war. And all of this is just by way of explaining why Westminster, the base of the administration for the exchequer and the king's judicial system, now had reasons to expand. And as such, it did. But as Westminster emerged into the 1220s, the biggest change it faced was a change in the leadership of the government. William Marshall, the regent of the young king, was an old man, and suddenly he fell very sick. Now, this illness did linger for a while. It was about 3.5 months after he was first diagnosed before he died. He was subjected to very sharp, sudden internal pains, and by the end, he could scarcely eat at all, kept alive for the last 15 days of his life on a diet of mushrooms and soggy bread. However, while his body was decaying, his mind and personality remained intact. When someone suggested near the end that William Marshall should sing in order to feel better, the old warrior supposedly said, quote, "Shut up, people will think I've gone mad," unquote. When William Marshall, the great regent, died, the appointment of the new government of the boy king was not sorted out in back rooms by powerful secret magnates and nobles. No, the great council of barons were called in Reading, in Oxford and Gloucester, and they themselves picked the new regime's leaders. A triumvirate was made of the new papal legate, a man called Pandulf, the Justiciar of England, who we just mentioned, and the Bishop of Winchester. And basically, they were to run the state for the young boy until he came of age. They were not always good at doing this, and rivalries were to become an issue. Meanwhile, in 1221, 13 monks of the new Dominican order of monastics arrived in England. These Dominicans were different from other monks. They were disciples of Dominic Guzman, a figure known to us today as Saint Dominic. And I last mentioned Saint Dominic a few chapters ago, where he was busy inspiring the crusade in the south of France stomp up and down on the heads of the Catharian heresy. This Castilian priest, Dominic Guzman, had established an order of friars mendicant in the year 1215. Friars mendicant was a term given to monks who were to give up their wealth, live lives of poverty amidst the poor, and serve the needs of their local communities, supposedly. The saint died in 1221 in Bologna. Just before his death, 13 of his friars stepped off a boat in England. The mainstay got as far as Canterbury and set up a house there, but a smaller group travelled on and arrived in London on August the 6th, the day, unbeknownst to them, that Dominic Guzman died. These Dominican friars were granted land within London to set up a house on the east side of Shoe Lane, on the top end, virtually opposite St. Andrew's Holborn, and this was given to them by the Justiciar of England, Hubert de Burgh. Here they remained until 1278, before they moved to a much larger, more long-term location. And the impact of these Dominicans, or black friars, as they were named based on the colour of their robes, was to be seen in London to this day. 1221 also saw the completion of something else. Way back in chapter 53 of the story of London, I described the ferocious fire of 1087, which had destroyed much of the city and had, above all, burned down St. Paul's Cathedral, as it was. I also described in the chapters that followed the beginning of the rebuilding of the Grand Church. Well, here we are, 130 years and 34 chapters later, and it was still not done. It would finally be done sometime in the next 20 years or so, but the grand wooden steeple was constructed around about the year 1221. It towered over the rest of London. Rest of the medieval church still had a ways to go before it was completed. Still, it had already seen some amazing events within it, not least of which being that moment only a few years earlier where the city declared Prince Louis of France was King of England within its halls. And that moment, by the way, that was still fresh in the memory of many Londoners. And it was to lead to the first indication that London and Westminster did not always get along. And thus we come to the story of the lamentable death this episode's named after. In telling this story, you have to understand there are supposedly two separate versions of what happened, differing accounts of violence between the residents of London and the residents of the newly expanding town of Westminster. The first one sounds like domestic rivalry gone wrong. You see, according to that, apparently, there was a wrestling match organised between the citizens of Westminster and the citizens of the City of London, to be held on July 25th in neutral middle ground near the leper hospital of St. Giles in the Fields. Now, wrestling back then was obviously not like wrestling now, although I do rather like the idea of a large gathering of Londoners to witness a 13th century version of All In. Whatever the case, the nice version of the story is that the London wrestlers easily defeated their Westminster rivals, and that a rematch was booked for August the 1st, 12-22. However, at that rematch, the supporters of the Westminster wrestlers decided to initiate the first recorded incident of a crew of sports fans deciding to throw down with rival sports fans and attacked and beat up the supporters of the London-based wrestlers. Well, that was it. They dared to come round to our manor and beat up our lads. London was having none of that. The same day, after licking their wounds and building up their courage in a proper state with some fortified ale, the Londoners decide to sally forth and take the battle back to Westminster, and led by a supposedly charismatic wrestling fan called Constantine, the fans of London rampaged through Westminster and apparently wrecked the new chapel being built at Westminster Abbey. And for this wrestling fan called Constantine was executed. Which by itself is a heck of an interesting story. However, there is a different version of the story that paints the events in a much more darker political light. That man called Constantine was not just a random wrestling fan. His full name was Constantine Fitz Æthelhulf, known at the time as more commonly as Constantine Fitz Æthelhulf. And he was one of the former sheriffs of London, a post he had held in 1197, 25 years previous to this date. Now, this lets us know that he was obviously a man of means, and probably one of the Eshkivins of the city. His unusual surname suggests that either from fashion, he decided to use an old English surname, or maybe, like the Fitz Aylwins, his family dated back in this city to pre-Norman days. We'll never know for sure. But a contemporary chronicler at the time described the circumstances that led to his execution as far more grounded in political reasons. According to that source, quote, "It befell on St. James's Day that at a wrestling match in London, much dissensions arose, that in the sedition that resulted therefrom, Constantine Fitz Æthelhulf cried aloud in an insulting tone, 'Mountjoy!'" Unquote. And this was an issue, as that selfsame account later qualifies. Quote, "Mountjoy, it may be remarked, was the war cry of the French Prince Louis and his adherents." Unquote. So in this version of the story, things are radically different. Yes, there had been a sporting match, a wrestling competition, and it may or may not have been between London and Westminster. It does seem that in this alternative version, some kind of row or discussion broke out amongst everybody watching the wrestling. And this former sheriff of London, in the midst of this discussion, began calling out the battle cry of Prince Louis. This was, of course, a very obvious dog whistle for the former supporters of the rebellion within London. But the source then says Constantine, during the row, went far beyond this political dog whistle. He went blatant and was, quote, "repeatedly exclaiming, 'May God help us and Louis, our Lord,' a fact that could not remain concealed," unquote. In this version, there is no violence, but there is basically sedition of the highest order. Such a thing could not be allowed to stand. The source says that the justiciar, quote, "collecting a force of armed men, proceeded to the Tower of London and commanded all the chief men of the city to appear before him. This being done, he inquired of them who had been the mover of sedition in the city. Constantine, constant in his presumption, said, 'It is I. What would you have?' The justiciar, on hearing this, arrested him without making any tumult, and two of his supporters with him," unquote. And so in this version, what we see is that apparently there was no violence. What there was, however, was an armed group of men arresting a former sheriff and a couple of the supporters in the Tower of London where all this building was going on. This immediately begs the question, why these two very different versions? And what can we make of the differences between the two versions of the story? It's significant that in the first version, Constantine is alleged to have attacked the chapel being built by Westminster Abbey. As I described previously, the laying of the foundation stone of this chapel had been part of Henry III's coronation rituals, which had happened only 2 years previously. In the first version of events, Constantine leads a mob of wrestling fans on a rampage into Westminster and attacks this building specifically. A huge sign to say his mob is targeting the king, at least symbolically. But the second version has no violence. Constantine's arrest was without tumult. But he is arrested for attacking the king nevertheless, by calling out openly in support of the cause of Prince Louis. It could be that the first version is trying to hide the nature of Constantine's crimes and allude to it via a very specific form of property damage. And it could be that the second version's claim there was no tumult was not strictly true. After all, before any of this started, the Justiciar of the Tower had insisted upon having a troop of armed men with him. He was clearly expecting trouble. But please also note what the second version includes. It says the Justiciar summoned the leading men of London. He then asked who was causing the sedition, and Constantine, who was at that gathering, replies straight away. If you want proof that Constantine wasn't just some radical, he was one of the Eschivans, it's right there. The next day saw this story come to bloody conclusion, when Constantine was sent to a man called Fawkes de Bruty. Now, this guy was different. He was one of the previous war's most loyal royalist commanders. Fawkes de Bruty was said to be the bastard child of a Norman knight and an unknown courtesan, but he'd risen in rank and favour due to his utterly unquestioning support for King John of England. De Bruty had served in many battles during the Civil War. He'd been one of the commanders at Lincoln, and he'd also gone on to commit acts we would today call war crimes when him and his forces fell upon St. Albans. He was one of the more militant members of the new regime's supporters. And according to the second version of the story, this was the man to whom former Sheriff Constantine was sent to, quote, attended by a troop of armed men, to be hanged, unquote. Again, this is no small matter. This is being treated as a rebellion by the authorities. It should be noted that Fawkes de Bruty and Hubert de Burgh, the Justiciar, did not get on at all. Fawkes was allied to the Bishop of Winchester and not the Justiciar. But they agreed to put aside their differences to put down this verbal rebellion and to facilitate this execution. And we get an idea of how big a figure Constantine actually was with what happened at his execution. Quote, on having the halter put around his neck, he offered 15,000 marks of silver for his life, unquote. But this incredible cash offer was being made to the wrong man. Fawkes was having none of it, and therefore, quote, Constantine was hanged, and the other two along with him, unquote. The circumstances around the death of Constantine FitzAnulf suggest to us that events in London were not sedate or placid during this era, that the cause of King Louis was still fresh in people's minds. It wasn't turned off, like in today's world, when we give up on a political cause, we don't just forget about it. Like today, there were people around who still flew the flag of the French prince. Now, this death of Constantine FitzAnulf does have a little sting in its tail, which I'll come back to later on. For now, we just need to return back to what was going on in London at the time. And actually, what I've got to do now is leave a verbal bookmark, mention something that will become more important in a later chapter. There was a small church located next to St. Paul's, known as St. Faith's. In fact, it was called St. Faith's by St. Paul's. As far as we can tell, while St. Paul's was the city's cathedral, St. Faith's was the parish church for the parish nearby to the north of St. Paul's, covering a large area from the left of St. Paul's, looking north, all the way to Newgate Street. Now, if the parish jurisdiction extended as far as the gate itself, I don't know, because on the other side of Newgate was a Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But I'm mentioning St. Faith's because that's going to become important in about a chapter or so's time. Anyway, for all of the reasons given earlier on, by 1223, the expansion of Westminster was making physical changes to the geography of the city itself. Because it is in this era, and around 1223, that we see the start of the development of Whitehall. Now, these days, Whitehall is the wide and somewhat monumental road leading from Trafalgar Square down to Parliament Square. In this era, it was actually two roads. The first started from the Turn. You see, as you walked out of Newgate, you'd walk along what we today now call Fleet Street and the Strand, and you'd turn left at what we now call Charing Cross, and that road then led to King Street, which itself ended at the Palace of Westminster and Westminster Abbey. In 1223, the area we today seen as Whitehall Palace and Horse Guards Avenue on the east side of the street was purchased by the justiciar Hubert de Burgh, and the buildings he gained were to later become a palace for the Archbishop of York and, in about five King Henry's time, transformed into Whitehall Palace itself. So we start the date of the development of this region of Whitehall to the life and times of Hubert de Burgh. And it's indicative that Westminster was growing and rising. And the final thing that cemented this rise took place a year later, round about the year 1225, when the general legal reforms that had been going on around the country, this general IRE, finally had an impact upon London. The King's Law Courts had long been based in and around Westminster, but it was more a tradition and not a formal arrangement. In 1225, it was agreed that the King's Bench should be fixed in Westminster. And it has remained here ever since. So the present law courts in the Strand are as near as possible to the border of the City of London. Thus we see a growing exchequer and a growing judiciary. And this is what was causing Westminster to expand towards London. Meanwhile, around the year 1224, arriving hot on the heels of those Dominicans, came another mendicant order of monks, the Order of the Franciscans. The students and disciples of St. Francis of Assisi came sent from him personally, and nine Franciscan friars reached England in 1224, five of them remained at Canterbury, and four came on to London, where they were given lodgings for 15 days in Holborn, and then they moved to a house over in Cornhill. In 1225, they were granted some land in Newgate Street on which to establish a priory. Now, the gifts of land given to them saw this priory grow in size until it bordered on Newgate Street to the south, St. Bartholomew's Hospital to the north, St. Martin le Grand's to the east, and the city wall to the west. Today's Christ Church is on the site of the choir of this priory, and to differentiate them from the Black Friars in the south, Londoners called these Franciscans by the colour of their robes. They were the Grey Friars. In front of the Grey Friars Priory, by the way, in the middle of Newgate Street, was a meat market called the Shambles, renowned for its smells and rather gruesome sights. And facing the street too was St. Nicholas Shambles, a church which we know began sometime in the 11th century. And there we kind of bring our chapter to the close, but with one final postscript to the story of the execution of Constantine Fitzanulf. You see, there's a little ghost of this moment in history that you can see upon the streets of London and across England to this day. You see, the man who killed Constantine Fitzanulf, Fawkes de Bruti, was to find himself in the next few years on the wrong side of the government. Without going too much into detail, Fawkes's rivalry with the justiciar Hubert de Burgh blew up only a year after he hung Constantine, and by November 1223 and in going into 1224, they saw Fawkes be part of a faction who actually attempted to seize the Tower of London. This anti-Justicar faction almost started a civil war, and that was only prevented by the direct intervention of Simon Langton. You may remember him, he's a former Chancellor of Prince Louis of France, and at the time he was acting Archbishop of York. In December 1223, peace talks in London failed to solve their issues, and Fawkes ended up on the losing side of a small armed uprising, which saw the anti-Justicar forces seize Bedford Castle, a nasty siege take place that lasted about 8 weeks, which saw 3 failed attempts at storming the place, which left over 200 dead, before the 4th attempt did take the castle, and all the rebels, including Fawkes' brother, were summarily executed. Fawkes himself surrendered and was sent into exile, and ended up being captured by the French king, the now King Louis, who remembered what he did back at the Battle of Lincoln, and anyway, long story short, he ended up dying in Rome many years later. And the only reason I'm telling you this little postscript, Fawkes owned a manor in South London, a grand hall known to the Londoners as Fawkes's Hall, or Fawkes Hall, and that was located over in Lambeth. In time, London pronunciations changed Fawkes Hall to Vauxhall, and that region has been known as Vauxhall ever since. Many hundreds of years later, in 1857, an ironworks was to be built in the region, and it was known as Vauxhall Ironworks. And in that ironworks, 46 years after it had been started, the company who owned it decided to build their first ever motor car. This sold well and was popular, and 2 years later this company decided to build a dedicated car manufacturing factory and picked a site in Luton in Bedfordshire to locate it. By utter coincidence, as well as holding the manor of Fawkes Hall, Fawkes also held the manor of Luton back between the years 1216 and 1226. As such, the company decided to name itself Vauxhall Motors in 1907 and supposedly claimed the symbol of the De Bruyter's coat of arms, the griffin, as a symbol of their cars. Fawkes's symbol lingers on the bonnet of every Vauxhall car to this day, and every single Vivaro or Corsa on the streets of London bears a shade of the lamentable death of Constantine FitzArnulf. As I've said before many times in this podcast, the ghosts of London's past are always just lingering, often in plain sight. Thanks for listening. I do so hope you enjoyed it. The Story of London is a podcast that can only exist via listener support, and I would like to thank those few listeners who've contributed and been a member for allowing us to keep going for another month. Your support is invaluable. If you'd like to become one and help us to keep going, well, help me to keep going, then you can do so over on the membership page of the Buy Me a Coffee site, which is linked via the website attached to this podcast. I'll be back next week with another episode in Book 4 of The Story of London. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Bye.